Kia ora and welcome to Better Off Red. My name's Pip Adam, and in this episode I speak with Sugar Magnolia Wilson, who is a fantastic poet. She's astounding. I love her work so much. So yes, yay, it's wonderful. As well as being an amazing poet, Magnolia is also one of the editors for Sweet Mammalian, which is a fantastic journal. So she's one of those wonderful people that we have in Wellington who not only writes amazing, beautiful poetry, but also facilitates the publication of other people's beautiful poetry. So yay, thank you very much for that. So Magnolia and I got together to discuss a movie that came out about 3 or 4 weeks ago. It's called Chasing Great. And yeah, it's pretty much the life story of Richie McCaw, who is possibly one of our most successful All Black captains. But interwoven into the story of his life is also the story of the 2015 Rugby World Cup and New Zealand's attempts to retain the Rugby World Cup. So yeah, it's an interesting film. We got together to talk about not only the way the film tells the story of a life and sort of the story of a rugby campaign and that sort of thing as well, but also to talk a little bit about rugby and the culture. So yeah, it was fantastic to talk to Magnolia. You can listen to this on iTunes. You probably know that. You're already there. If you feel like rating us, that would be fantastic. If you feel like leaving a review, we'd be most appreciative. You can also find links on a web page we've got, which is at betterrednz.wordpress.com. That's betterred, R-E-A-D-N-Z.com, .wordpress.com. So yeah, come along there if you like. We are also on Facebook and Twitter, and yeah, if you've got any comments, it'd be great to hear them. Anyway, I hope you enjoy this. I like to think of this as sort of poetry and rugby intersecting. It's interesting. I enjoyed the movie a lot more than I anticipated, and it was a challenging watch and a challenging think. And yeah, I think the conversation with Magnolia, I just appreciated it so much because it helped me sort of untangle some of the complicated thoughts I have about enjoying sport and enjoying art. So yeah, I hope you enjoy it. Thanks, Heath. Okay, so here we are. I am with Sugar Magnolia Wilson. How are you?
Good, I'm good.
Very good. You have walked down the hill and come to my house.
I have. Yes. I'm on Aperni Street for the first time in my... Well, I've been halfway up Aperni Street, but never this far up. And yeah. I think it's a beautiful, beautiful street.
It's a very nice street, yeah. We're way at the end. Way at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very nice. So we're sitting up here and the sun's coming in. It's very nice. Today we are going to be talking about the film Chasing Great, which I guess could be described as a biopic of Richie McCaw's life.
Mm.
And, you know, sort of leading up to those that very successful end of his career, rugby career. Now, the way this came about is that I saw the trailers for this movie in August, I think, and felt very queasy about the idea of sort of putting this big production behind what seemed to be a very humble and quiet kind of dude.
Yeah.
You know, like, and it seemed like the music was kind of, and the spectacle, the way the movie was being made was sort of at odds with this person. And I was sort of talking to people about doing a podcast about it, and I thought that was going to be a really sarcastic kind of like, what a dumb thing, rugby. But then you and I were walking home one night. It was poetry night.
It was, yep, National Poetry Day.
National Poetry Day. And there was a poster for it, and I said, oh, check that out. And you said to me, well, maybe he's just a guy. And I just thought, yeah. And then I went and saw it, and I thought you were the person I wanted to talk to about it because you like rugby, you know stuff, and then you've got that whole other sort of bow, you know, as a poet, you are all about shaping lives and shaping narratives and stuff. So I went and saw it, and then was, I went and saw it a couple of weeks ago and thought it was fantastic.
Mm, so did I, which took me by surprise.
Yes, I think that's probably a disclaimer we need to get out of the way. I thought it was quite an amazing piece of cinema, really.
So did I, and I really don't know whether it's because I went in with such low expectations.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of went in feeling almost resentful, like not towards you, but towards the idea of having to sit and listen to the life story of someone who I didn't perceive to be particularly interesting.
Mm,
and I found that that was kind of not turned on its head in that he turned out to be, like, super interesting, but turned on its head in some other ways, which, yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like, I was thinking, I was very keen to see the rugby footage. Like, I get very excited about sport, and the idea of seeing that on a big screen with beautiful music behind it and all that sort of choreographed kind of hype and all that, I was very excited about that, but I was very unsure about Richie McCaw as this, you know, as this sort of centre of the thing.
Yes, like how would what I perceived him to be like as a person, how could that possibly carry a story that could be interesting?
Mm.
And I guess for me, coming out of it, and it's always great when you're asked to think about something in the first place. It always means you watch something with a much kind of stronger eye for the detail of what's really going on. And I found I came out more of a rugby fan than I went in, and I'm already a rugby fan, but I also came out thinking a lot about, I guess, a power and where money goes in New Zealand and why, and actually finding Richie McCaw quite an unusual person.
Mm.
Like, great, but more unusual than I'd thought.
Yeah, because, I mean, some of the aspects that surprised me about him was that incredibly stellar academic record, I guess is just me and my prejudices, always thinking that it's got to be sport or brains. You can't have both. And then I think we both talked about the really interesting stuff around the... Now, what did he call himself? Forensic psychiatrist.
Yes, it's a forensic psychiatrist. Yeah. Yes, that was fascinating.
Yeah, like those whole ideas of sort of hitting walls and how someone, you know, sort of gets through those really hard times.
Yes.
So what do you think it is about maybe the shape of the story, like the way that the story of his life is told, that does turn some of those ideas about him on the head,
right,
so to speak?
Well, I guess the first thing I kind of noticed was, and I think this is maybe a bit of background to that question, is that they really did put the entirety of his life within the winning of two World Cups.
Mm.
So everything that his life meant was about rugby. There was almost nothing, actually there was nothing else that really seemed in the film to be told. It was quite amazing. So it kind of starts off in 1987 and we win the World Cup in a game against France. And that's one of the first games he remembers seeing. And I think it's one of the first games I remember seeing too. Mm. And I'm the same age as Richie McCaw. And as I kind of went through the story with him, I was thinking, yes, my life's kind of been shaped by this rugby trajectory too, which is kind of amazing. And then they take you right through. And the whole way through his life story is the background of the 2015 World Cup. So it's all about, is he going to be able to sort of do this for New Zealand? And I thought that was a really interesting way to frame someone's life, because obviously there's got to be more to his life than that. But what I thought was very interesting was I did not expect him, and the way I perceive him, to be someone who was so inquisitive. I didn't realise that it was him more so than someone like Steve Hansen, although I think Steve Hansen probably played a huge part in it too, who sought out how to break through that mentality around failure, which I think is one of the key sort of stories in that, be it true or not, is the sense that, I think, what was the phrase, we are the world's best except when it counts.
Yeah.
That kind of mentality that New Zealanders are good enough to do it, but when the pressure's on, we break down. Mm. And I think that's a kind of story that we tell ourselves as New Zealanders. And I think a lot of that story was actually riding on the All Blacks as they moved from 1987 through, lost in 2007, when Richie McCaw knew that they were a good enough team. And then he sought out that forensic psychologist, who was an interesting guy himself.
Yeah.
Yes, he sought him out. What surprised me and what turned sort of my perceptions of Richie on its head was that I didn't realise Richie was into that kind of stuff, basically.
Yeah.
You know?
Because it was really, the thing that I found interesting about that whole sort of like challenge of failure is that it seemed to be asked backwards to or complete incomplete contradiction to what I think about as sports psychology.
Right.
Like, I always think sports psychology is, I'm the greatest,
yes.
you know.
Yes.
Whereas what it seemed to be is like this almost Jungian idea yes. that you delve into the darkness.
Yes, totally.
And I just found that so astounding, especially like, you know, the point where he's talking about that game that's going badly, and he just sort of talks about suddenly realizing that this was the dark point that he'd been mentally preparing for all this time.
He was able to recognize that. Yeah.
And that just blew my mind because, yeah, like I say, I'm always interested in how we frame true stories, especially around sport, because I think there is this real... And that was my fear, I think, when I saw the trailers, is that I thought there's this language and there's this narrative that we keep telling ourselves about sport, you know, and I think that somehow the film managed to jump away from that, eh?
I think so too. I did think it managed to get away from that.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, that switching around of the narrative, you know, like, I mean, it does seem to, there's something about it that sort of is a little bit normal, you know,
yes.
like conventional,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, you know, sort of the young boy. That was another thing that blew my mind, is that everybody seemed to comment on the fact that he was not naturally the most gifted player.
I know. Yeah. I think that's actually a part of him that I found really interesting, and I think it was Steve Hansen who described him as a complicated rooster.
Yes.
And I think that said quite a lot about him. Like, I think maybe he wasn't naturally maybe the most graceful or sort of, I don't know, maybe he wasn't the best player on the team. But, well, yeah, I didn't quite realise that. I think a rooster is something quite interesting to call someone. It talks about kind of a sense of showiness and a sense of needing to be seen, but also a complicated rooster and what's really going on under the surface of Richie. Because I did feel like at the end of the documentary that while I had gained an insight into aspects of him, I still really knew very, very little about him. And I didn't know whether that was because, is there more? Is there more to him? There must be. And I think he and Kerry, the psychologist, they must have, in that real kind of going to those deep places, talking about how to make it through those really challenging times on the field. And you've got the pressure of a nation in quotation marks, on your shoulders. You know, you talk about that kind of stuff and you don't not talk about other things. So I think there's other parts to him. I hope there's other parts to him. Because, yeah, I didn't really come out knowing much more about him than other than he's more kind of into pushing the boundaries a lot more than I'd expected. Yeah.
And I think, you know, that shows kind of quite a great respect on the part of the filmmakers, I guess, as
yes.
well. Like, even those very, some of the scenes with his partner felt very, very staged.
Oh, no, yes.
Like, there's a scene where they sort of come in and sit on the couch and he's doing the crossword and he says something like, it's very hard today.
Yeah.
And she says, you say that every day. And
And they're sitting, like, 2 metres apart from each other. Like, the intimacy is just, like, and they're kind of, yeah, I don't know, that was weird.
And I do think that, yeah, I think this is one of the things that I found super interesting about it, is that when someone like Dan Carter comes on, you're kind of like, oh,
yes.
oh, like a bit of warmth and a
yes.
bit of humour and a bit of...
Because he cried. Did you see him in some of the footage crying when Richie had played his 100th, whatever, I can't even remember what it was, but he was showing emotion, like almost on behalf of, and it was necessary, because otherwise it would have been a very emotionless thing, you know.
Because that was one of the things that I guess the week that I watched it, the Chiefs controversy was going on. You know, the rugby team had a night out. They hired a stripper and then proceeded to sexually assault her. I don't know what you say, apparently, or whatever that word is.
Yeah.
And, you know, they responded to that in all sorts of very interesting ways.
Yeah.
And, well, terrible ways. And I was just thinking about how this film does seem to reinforce that idea of a strong, silent man.
Totally, yeah.
And, you know, like, with the sort of comparison you know, putting him into the South Canterbury landscape alone. There's one very key image, which is of him in a glider by himself in the silence.
Quite amazing.
Above, quite incredible. And I was just, I was thinking about where that sits in 2015,
definitely,
where you have figures like Dan Carter, Sonny Bill Williams, you know, you have these kind of quite, you know, their masculinity is slightly more complicated than,
yes,
you know, I was just wondering, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, one of my sort of initial thoughts going into the documentary and beginning to watch it was, why isn't this about Tana Umaga?
Why isn't
it about Sonny Bill Williams? I'm much more interested in seeing a story about one of those men. And I kind of, yeah, I thought that sort of first 10 or 15 minutes in. And I think, you know, one of the complicated things about the film, as you say, is how his sexuality was presented. He was kind of presented as not really having any kind of sexuality.
Mm.
Like, he seems quite, in a way, quite a passionless person, even though he's so driven and so full of passion. But what were they trying to tell us? Were they trying to say he's never had sex before? Not that that's our business to know, but they really did present him as though he hasn't lived at all outside of rugby.
Mm.
And of course he has.
Mm.
And it goes back to that, what do we not know about him? Not that there are terrible things to know, but if behaviour like has happened with Scarlett and the Chiefs is going on, we know that it's been happening throughout rugby's history.
Mm.
We know that kind of treatment towards women has possibly been going on behind the scenes. And the fact that that Chiefs thing was dealt with internally rather than externally says so much about sort of battening up the hatches kind of thing. So, yeah, I found that a really, really complicated thing. And I found myself longing to see more of people like Sonny Bill and Dan Carter on screen. So, yeah, I found that complicated. And this might be a good time to talk about, I was talking to Hannah Mettner, my good friend, about that you and I were going to be talking about this. And she said, oh, well, that's fitting because isn't the first poem you ever had published about Richie McCaw?
Mm.
And I was like, oh, my God, I'd totally forgotten about it. So and it was kind of topical as well because it's about sex and rugby. And it's a poem that I submitted to the Lee and Washington Review Press, though in New Zealand, a New Zealand issue, and I submitted it, and it's called National Anxiety. And they asked us to submit a poem along with an artwork. Mm-hmm. So I contacted Nigel Brown, the New Zealand artist, who does those paintings of men called, like, I Am Black Singlet.
Mm-hmm.
And it will have a man in the foreground wearing a black singlet with the kind of I am behind him, and in the background maybe there's a wife or a woman holding a baby, and really kind of like archetypal imagery. So I submitted my poem along with Nigel Brown's artwork. He was happy to put it forward, and I thought I could read it out.
Yeah, that'd like be fantastic.
It's short.
I would so love that.
Cool. So it's called National Anxiety, and when the Lee and Washington Review read through it, they asked me to change the name Richie McCaw to just the captain of the All Blacks. They wanted the Americans reading it to be able to know what they were reading about. And also they asked me to do a footnote saying that Jelly Baby is like a kind of gummy bear, which was really cute. So, National Anxiety. The party is loud and seems to go on forever. Shoes stomp to the beat along gummy hardwood floors. Late in the night, when bodies finally hang like deflated lilos over couches, you in someone else's room where the walls are only dirty white sheets have rough sex with Richie McCaw. He is much more aggressive than you'd imagined. His TV persona, a giant jelly baby implanted with a sporting platitudes chip, isn't quite as sweet as. A short time after ripping off your black undies and going down, he surfaces furiously to inform you that your Brazilian isn't up to par. You might want to rethink your strategy, work on your game, if you know what he means, for the national good. And I'm aware reading that now could be kind of considered slander. But hey! I mean, it's fictional, but it's that sense that I had growing up in New Zealand at parties and just in general kind of rural New Zealand that not that men came first, but that, like, it kind of did in a way revolve around men and their sexuality.
Mm.
And, yeah, I sort of, for me, that, yeah, poem is about the complicated nature of, I guess, New Zealand's perception of how we want to be seen on the world stage, but the kind of underbelly of that and what it is really going on. So,
because yeah. I think that is one thing that I felt I must admit I did feel discomfort at when I was watching the movie was just this reiteration of strong, silent man.
Totally.
You know, and kind of, I mean, and this is why I kind of wanted so much more of his partner. You know, like, she's a world-class hockey player.
Mm.
She's an amazing person in a lot of ways, his equal, you know, sort of sporting-wise. And, you know, then it made me start to think about women's sport in New Zealand.
Yes.
And, like, how, yeah, I don't know, like, our women's rugby team does so well. And,
totally.
You know, you have to, like, go right down the channels to see that.
Yes, I know.
And I just, yeah. I totally agree. Like, and I think that it is so interesting when you look, like, because that was something I really noticed in the footage at the end, is that there was very little of Sonny Bill Williams. And I did wonder if maybe someone's planning a film.
Right.
Which made me quite excited.
Yes.
Because I think when you look at that figure, and, like, my, you know, my perception of that figure in sport is, you know, like, it's so different. You know
yeah.
what I mean? And I just, it was really interesting. I don't know. I just found it all interesting. And I think that poem is so, you know, because that's the other thing is, like, you enjoy watching rugby.
Yeah.
I enjoy watching rugby. I often watch more rugby league than rugby, which
yes,
is an even
fan, right?
which is an even more complicated position.
Yep.
You know, like
yep.
that. Yeah, not yeah, the messy bog of rugby league culture. But you know, I mean, that it is always interesting to hold those two things in your mind, eh?
Yeah, I think I think the people I enjoy the most in life are ones who can hold slightly polarizing places in their own heart. You know what I mean? It's like, I think rugby league, everything in the world is potentially one thing and another and another and another. So, I don't know, I think, like we were talking about before, like rugby league, they're like giant octopuses with these multiple tentacles, and some of those tentacles are so good and so amazing, and like the doco, you know, just blew my mind, really, some of the length that he and they went to. But then some of those tentacles are so sort of dark, and I think it's always good to have simultaneous things happening.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's yeah.
I totally agree, because I think that is the thing, you know, like, you know, I mean, we keep trying to polish off rugby.
Totally.
Not you and I particularly, yeah. but, you know, like, as a country, we keep trying to polish it off, and yet, you know, like, there was the comparison made to war, which I thought was really interesting.
Definitely.
And I know it's sort of a cliched comparison, but it wasn't until it was made in the film that I suddenly thought, fuck, this is a brutal sport.
Yes.
You know, and, like, that's the other thing that I thought. I read a couple of reviews, one review, and I also read a little bit, there's a very interesting article about Richie McCaw and the concussions that he's suffered.
Right.
And I watched a couple of, because I don't know what it says about me, I'm dark, but I watched there's a couple of sort of shots of him being knocked out on the field and stuff like that, and I was just thinking, far out, you know. I know with league, because it's even more grumpy and kind of aggressive, there is that weird thing that just always, I don't know what it's like with rugby, but I know having, been in relationships with rugby league players, that always bubbles over into the club rooms. You know, like, it always...
Yeah. It's not contained on the field.
No.
Yeah, totally.
And, yeah, I felt like the film, I don't know, like, to have this soft, quiet man and then compare that to the sort of aggression on the field, I thought was a really interesting thing.
Yes, and that is another thing that surprised me about him, is that people do totally perceive him as this really kind of wholesome dude, and I really don't know if that's actually the case in terms of how he plays the game.
Yeah,
like, I think he's actually what intrigued me is that, and I kind of knew, but just it made it more solid in my mind, was the whole, you know, in the last World Cup, the Richardy Grubb thing, standing in the way of the Australians winning this big Richardy grab on the field.
Mm.
And the perception from other rugby nations that Richie is a cheat.
Mm, mm.
And that he does actually play dirty, but in a different kind of way. Mm. And I think that's something that is quite long-standing, and it's a sporting thing. I think, you know, sports has always kind of been on that line. But I think it took me back to my mum telling me about Sean Fitzpatrick. And she said to me, I was like, you know, he seems like a, you know, like he's a really good captain and yada yada. And she was like, yeah, he is. But he is, the stuff he says to people apparently on the field is extraordinary.
Mm.
He was a psychological, he would get into the minds of the players he was with and the kinds of things he would say to them apparently. I mean, this is just hearsay, but I think it's quite a well-known thing about him. And I think, yeah, I think that intense kind of, it's just like a sort of extreme violence on the field, isn't it? It's like, yeah.
Well, there's the shot of him reaching out to grab, you know, like completely illegally kind of tripping someone up. And like, I that was one of the most astounding parts for me as well. And I think that it might have been from a sort of, reading too many books, fiction kind of way, is that he just seemed like nice guy, nice guy, nice guy. And then as soon as there was just, and I think the film, I mean, I would have loved to have seen more of it, but I think that it was pretty open about it. Like, it talked to the Australian captain and, you know, and I was just so excited by this fact that, you know, like, part of the reason we all cheer for him and think he's a good guy is the fact that there is this side of him where he knows the referees that he's coming up against. He's always playing on the line. Like, I had dinner with James George, who's a writer from Auckland, the other night, and I was sort of talking to him about that aspect of the film, and he was saying, yeah, well, the position that he plays, if you're not getting called offside, then you're not playing close enough to the offside.
Right.
He was sort of saying, you know, like, yeah, that would be a shitty, you know, that would be a shitty player if they weren't, and I just
they
thought
weren't pushing that boundary.
Kind of really excited me as well. And I just feel like I wish there had been maybe even a little bit more about that
because that's, you know, that is my experience with New Zealand sport in general. So, like, I was never really a sporting kid, but I did go through a little netball phase, and the reason I didn't carry on was because of on the court. It was the scariest place. I was just not made for that kind of, you know, defence. The person you're up against who's sort of marking you. They were terrifying. And they were, like, terrifying on a psychological level. Like, they were hardcore girls who just weren't going to have a bar of me. And that's just at, like, 10-year-old netball. And that kind of culture is, it's kind of amazing, but it's not, definitely not for everyone. But I do think, you know, that kind of culture and how that can tie back into things like, I guess there are those questions around what rugby means in terms of violence in society, and I think those are some really big questions. I don't necessarily think that rugby is what causes violence, so like I don't necessarily think it's like, you know, somebody that, you know, or the All Blacks lose a game and then that is the reason why domestic violence happens and things like that. But I do think if what's happening is also really intensely physical and so much about that adrenaline pumping through the veins and about a sense of national identity riding on that, I think it's, you know, sort of par for the course that it's going to have a knock-on effect as well. And I'd actually had an experience of my own with that. I was on Queen's Wharf for the 2011 Rugby World Cup. It was with, like, thousands of other people, and it was the France-New Zealand game. And everyone was really excited at first because, you know, we were going to win, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then as the game went on, it became very apparent that it was highly likely we weren't going to win. It was like the fight of their lives. Like, that was one of the moments I respected Richie the most, I think, was he just, and he did that whole World Cup, was it that one or the 15 one where he had a fractured foot?
I think it was the 11.
It was the 11, and I think that was an extraordinarily painful thing that he was, anyway, he fought like, just like a dog, basically, they all did. And the crowd got quieter and quieter and quieter as this kind of sense of like, hope slipped away. It was quite a profound, strange, religious kind of feeling. And behind me, and this is actually kind of a shameful story on my part, behind me there were like some people, and they were sort of jeering at the team and jeering, you know, saying, oh, you stupid, blah, 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 blah. And I turned around and I said, if you don't shut the fuck up, I'm going to smash your face in. And I said that to someone, and I'd had one beer, and I turned around and I was like, oh, and so my friend was like, Magnolia, and I was like, oh my God, like, and I just sort of stood there, but I felt so incensed that there were these people trying so hard to do something for everyone on that wharf, and these people were standing there kind of mocking, and I felt like I'd just been sucked into the biggest, you know, I'd just fully been sucked into this thing, and the mood when we won was just people... like a tsunami up Queen Street, just chanting and French people crying, and it was just extraordinary. But you know, and then I wandered along the street, and there were a couple of police officers, and I said, "Oh my God, are you happy we won the game?" And he one of them said to me, "Oh, fuck off." And I was like, "Whoa, okay, I'm just asking you if you enjoyed the game, you know." And he was like, "I told you to fuck off." And I was like, "Don't talk to me like that. And he pushed me, and I fell on the ground. And I got up and said, "You don't have the right to touch me. You're not allowed to touch me. I've not done anything wrong." And he pushed me again. And so I stood up, and I punched him in the face. And I got arrested. And then they took me down to this, like... they had set up these containers down at the shipping yard, and they were holding people in them, like pens. And it was full of people like me who'd gotten kind of carried away, and, like, although this specific police thing wasn't, but the vibe was like, you know, people were really riled up in a good way, but were kind of, like, intense, and full of people who, one of the guy I was with said, "You know, why are you here?" And I was like, "Oh, I asked the police if they were happy we'd won," and he said, "Oh, well, I had a knife fight with..." So, you know, I'm not making light of it, but the kind of, like, me as someone who I consider myself quite a mild-mannered, although I'm not always mild-mannered, but you know what I mean, like, I feel like I haven't even keel most of the time. I think if rugby can affect me that way, it can affect other people that way too, and sort of gave me an insight into how things get out of control. Yeah.
I totally relate to that. Like, I think that someone once said that sports... how did they put it? They said it's so exciting because it matters so much, but for a short amount of time, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you can sort of isolate it out of your day. And yeah, I've done, like, my daughter, I remember screaming at the Warriors one day at the television set, and, you know, really violent shit that I would say to nobody.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, just, you know, abuse, and, like, I think even calling people names because of the way they looked and all sorts of stuff like that. And Tallulah just looked at me and she was just like, "What the fuck?"
Yeah.
You know, and I think I can totally, there is something so, I don't know, like, it just plays so wickedly and just means so much. And I think I love that comparison to religion, because it totally feels like that sometimes.
It does, definitely. I mean, I remember we were at the opening game for the 2011, which I think was New Zealand and Samoa. New Zealand and Fiji, I forget. But I'd never been to a live rugby game before that.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is a church. This is a church. And I was so surprised by how tiny the pitch was.
Yeah, yeah.
It's microscopic. And it was like, is this what it's all been about? Like, I was really kind of like, whoa, this is not quite as spectacular as I thought. But it was, and then Sonny Bill came on the pitch and took his shirt off. Ooh. And the whole crowd, well, every female was like, ooh, like this gigantic, it was just hilarious. And then, yeah, I just remember thinking there's a real religious vibe here, and for a, is it, what's the word, partisan, what's the, yeah, for a partisan country like New Zealand, it makes sense that something else brawny and kind of to do with hardening up would become the, you know,
yeah,
be hard and get over that line kind of would be the thing.
Yeah, no, I do. I totally know what you mean. Like, I remember the first time I remember one game in particular that was in Otago when I was at university down there, which was a whole another experience. But I remember that thing of the thing that really surprised me is that these people that I had seen on TV and, you know, were, you know, sort of sat in that part of my mind as almost, gosh, maybe I thought of them as almost computer game things, yeah, or something, yeah, avatars or something, but yeah, to be that close to them on the pitch and just, yeah, see that some of them are taller than others and some of them are, yeah, shorter, and, you know, people that you thought were quite small are actually huge.
Yes.
And I mean, it's really a strange experience, and I think that's why I just feel like the film sort of the footage that it had of the rugby was just perfect, really, wasn't it? And it didn't feel like regular. I don't know how much of it came from proper, you know, like television and stuff, but there was just something so fucking, I don't know.
About it. Yeah. That footage of Richie after, I think you've referred to it already, when he's been kind of almost knocked out and he's on his knees trying to get up, and I think the woman is the sports health person is saying to him, you know, do you think you should be off the pitch? And he's like, are you insane? But you can see in his eyes, he's not kind of all there. He's like trying his hardest to get himself back, get back into his physical body. He's like been knocked out of it, and he's clawing, and he does. He's learned enough to, from his, I guess, his psychologizing, to pull himself back from a place that physically I think a lot of other people would not be able to come back from, you know.
Which is kind of horrifying in that way when you do start to think it's a game.
Like dragging your corpse around.
Yeah. And like, because that was the thing I thought about the foot. Like there's that line in it where, I can't even remember who says it, but someone says something like, I knew it was broken, he knew it was broken.
Steve Hansen.
Yeah, but we weren't asking any questions because then we knew morally we'd have to do something about it.
No one wanted to say the words because that meant we'd have to do something.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh my God, so nobody just even talked about that he had a broken foot because they needed him to keep playing. That was amazing.
And just the thought, like looking at that footage with that knowledge now, like I didn't know that at the time, but just imagining every time that foot hits, this bone kind of just crumbling a little bit more and a little bit more.
And every time someone's on top of you and it's like, yeah.
I just, yeah, and the concussion, right, yeah. The concussion stuff just really terrifies me, you know, like, I just, I don't know, like, I read a couple of articles, there was quite a good one in Metro by, I think, Donna Chisholm about concussion in sport, and, yeah, and there was one article that I found, which was way back in 2009, where I think Richie McCaw made an offhand comment about having concussion, and they were saying, this is not a good message to our young players, and all that sort of stuff, and I was just thinking, in one of the interviews I actually read with him when the film came out, he was talking about the reason that he wanted to do the film was to sort of show younger people that, you know, this career was possible sort of thing, but, man, it would be, I just don't know how you would feel if, you know, like, you sort of lost your life for this game.
I know.
Because it's not... I know there's a lot of money in it now. I know. I understand all that. But it's not about money, is it?
It's not about money. No. It's... I don't know what it's actually about. I feel like it's about so many things. I mean, part of it's about the glory, I think. I mean, I felt like Richie... I think it was quite public as well that he struggled with retirement. You know, retiring from the game. And... He, you know, at the end of the 2015 World Cup, you know, he's like, he says, who wouldn't want this? And you can see in him that apparently he's just done some really intense thing as well for charity, like Tough Mudder or one of those big things. And you can see how you'd get, potentially addicted to that kind of payoff, like that kind of putting yourself so out there on the line. I scribbled on my notebook when I was watching the docker, I was like, you know, it's like the ultimate kind of heartbreak, and how heartbreak's like the biggest teacher you can have. Like, you know, if you leading something is, you know, as important to New Zealand as the All Blacks team, and you lose, I think the kind of heartbreak you must go through is extraordinary, and also probably your biggest teacher, as it proved to be for Richie. But it's just, but it just takes me back to that complicated rooster thing, like what motivates someone to drive themselves that hard. And it does remind me of people like my dad and my brother, who have in their lives are very complex men. They are, you know, they've been sports people. Dad was a boxer for years, and my brother was a rugby player for years. My dad was someone who almost like chased concussions. You know, he'd climb a tree drunk and then just let go and fall. He'd drive off into a ditch, and he'd box in the head 10 million times. And I feel like he almost sought that kind of as a punishment of or something to, I don't know why though, like I don't know what that means, but I sort of see that in New Zealand men quite a bit, and it doesn't mean that they're not really soulful, deep people, but it's interesting.
Because I mean, there is, I often think about this sort of body idea, you know, like this, because, you know, we have this weird thing where we separate mind and body, you know, like we've got this idea that, you know, like, you know, but then it just becomes so intrinsic, doesn't it? You know, like the body kind of, we can make the body go further if the mind's in the right condition kind of stuff and that sort of thing. And Yeah, I was thinking that idea of pain is so interesting, and you know, I was even thinking about it the other day when I was in yoga, not rugby, yoga. Yeah. But you know, and I was in a lot of pain, and I was just thinking, this actually feels, this is a different experience to have in my body, and I think that, and I wanted more of it. Yes. You know what I mean? Yeah. And I think that there is this really interesting thing with physical, especially fitness and sport. You know, like my partner before Brent was a boxer and rugby league player, and I've seen him on the field dislocate a finger and kind of just whack it back into place, and you know, like, and the boxing has, you know, like, I mean, the boxing is a weird sport because you are going to get hurt. Yes. Like, there's just, you know, that's,
and in the head.
Yes, always in the head. And I just think that there is something so interesting about this relationship between bodies. You know, like, and I just wonder, you know, and especially, like, that's why I totally get that thing of people, the weird audience relationship as well, of sort of saying, come on, are you fucking, you know, and just thinking, wow, you know, like, there is an experience that I imagine would be a craving experience, you know.
Definitely, like, yeah, I agree, I think, and it's funny you mentioned yoga, because the thing that came to mind was I did a meditation course called Vipassana, where you 10 days of no speaking and you do meditation all day, kind of thing. And one of the key aspects of Vipassana is that you sit in a pose, you know, a meditative pose, you get to choose, but once you're in it, you're not to move. And it becomes painful. The most sort of normal cross-legged pose after an hour becomes excruciatingly painful. But that process of not allowing the body to tell the mind what to do, and after a while that subsides and goes away, and another kind of realization occurs, or something changes, you know, where an old mind pattern that has told you how to do specific things disappears almost. Something that's keeping you in a specific way of going through something disappears, and you can move on from that. And I wonder, I guess that's why for me the doco was so fascinating, because Richie actually did go down that path. Like, he got to 2007 and realized that they were good enough, but something had happened psychologically that hadn't allowed them to push through that, and he actually sought that out, which was very cool. And I don't know, I mean, he obviously had the money to do that.
Yeah.
Immense amounts of money from the rugby union. But I did think that was really interesting, and I wonder what he has realised along the way that he hasn't, that wasn't in the documentary.
Yeah, what I found really interesting is at the end, I mean, and this is totally my projection, because I, you know, team sports have not been a big part of my life since I was, I think the last time I played, I mean, I played a lot of team sport, but I don't think I've played since I was in about fourth form or fifth form. Oh, I've had a couple of, like, social netball teams and social soccer teams and stuff like that, but they tried, at the end, the documentary seemed to want to say that what he'll miss is the camaraderie of his teammates.
Yeah.
Yet, I think that it's so much more complicated than that, and the things, you know, like, I mean, I don't know, like, my parents were very big on team sport because they thought it taught something. I think what it taught me was that I didn't like team sports. But, like, but I thought that was interesting, those scenes in the, I thought the most telling scene actually was there's a shot where someone is dancing, but they have their phone up taking footage of themselves dancing.
Yes, and I was just
thinking, yeah, like, these relationships between men, what would that look like? You know, like, yeah.
Totally. And that sort of put alongside the really lonesome images of him. Or not lonesome, but the whole kind of man alone sort of aspect. So, you know, missing the camaraderie and missing the sort of the glory and all that kind of stuff. But then it's almost like the film was saying, now he's done what New Zealand needed him to do, he's free of that.
Yes.
And he's in his glider over the plains of the South Island, free because he's proven he's man enough. Or something like that, you know, and it's, and yeah, and I don't know, and yeah, I don't know. I thought those scenes in the changing rooms after the game, I think after the end of the 2015 World Cup, when they're celebrating, were kind of amazing. Yeah, they were an amazing look into how modern the team is. You know, how young like Richie's old compared to the rest of them. They're kind of 19, 20, and they're listening to Justin Bieber and like dancing around, and they're a really dynamic, socially aware, kind of media savvy group. Yeah, it was some interesting messaging.
And I think I think you're so right about that arc of the story, like, because it's almost like, I mean, this is I'm totally fucking overreading it now, but even the idea that after completing the task, the hero also gets his princess as well.
Yes.
You know, like, it's this weird thing of sort of this weirdly asexual kind of build-up where there's no talk of girlfriends, no photos of going to school balls, no, you know, nothing like that.
Nothing.
And then it's almost like you have now done it and here is your woman kind of thing, which is just, I don't know, like, I found that so interesting. Like,
I know, and it can't be true.
Well,
can it be true?
Well, I wondered, like, I kept thinking to myself, is this, you know, like, is this... Yeah, am I missing something? Are there people that live their lives like this?
Yeah.
You know, and you see, not knowing many, you know, proper professional sports people, I don't know. Maybe this is a thing. Yet, you know, when you look at someone like Sunny Williams, you know, there seems to be this vital private life.
Yeah.
You know, like this exciting, passionate kind of like other thing. And I mean him as well, because, you know, he's done everything.
Yeah.
You know, he keeps switching around. But yeah, I did find it really, really interesting.
Yeah.
And that's, I think also those shots of the team at the end, I totally hear what you're saying about, you know, the idea of, you know, the idea of a modern team. Like, I couldn't help thinking, like, when I was a kid, rugby players had other jobs. Like, they tended to be, I don't know, like, I remember someone was a butcher and someone was a farmer. And,
yes.
You know, like, there were the ads for Pine Tree Meads putting in his fence posts and stuff like that. And that was something I really thought, is there is this complicated relationship with celebrity, I think, now.
Definitely, yeah.
Which, especially with the younger, you know, especially with the younger players, there is this odd kind of, there is celebrity.
There is celebrity, yeah, totally. And New Zealand, as we know, in general terms, has a bit of a problem with celebrity.
So, yeah, we do have a complicated kind of relationship with celebrity, eh?
Yeah, I think we do. Like, I think that comes up in things when you have, like, you know, obviously the All Blacks, but things like the Real Housewives of Auckland.
Yeah.
That model of celebrity feels really uncomfortable in New Zealand, and probably feels really uncomfortable for a lot of New Zealanders. But also, you know, people like Eleanor Catton, you know, who've had to kind of defend themselves for having opinions that aren't the national, perceived to be the national opinion, you know. And I think it's really, really interesting. It's, I don't know if it's a symptom of a small country where we're all kind of up in each other's business and our own confidence rides on the confidence of others. And but I do think there's a complicated thing there, and I think that people like Eleanor and people like the All Blacks, I think they're the ones who are sort of pushing us past that in a way. Like, I feel with what this current All Blacks team under Richie sort of pushed through, like, a glass ceiling of self-confidence, of, like, we fail, like I said, we fail in the moments when it matters most, I feel like is something New Zealand has kind of struggled against. And from my point of view, I don't know if it's true or not, but, yeah.
No, I totally agree. I think, because I keep thinking of that image of John Key shaking Richie McCaw's hand in the dressing room, and how, like, I had so much respect for Richie McCaw in that moment, because he refused to politicise, you know, obviously that was a very political, you know, like, that's a political photograph, but there did seem to be, you know, like, there wasn't sort of this charge of, you know, like, yay, you know, this is where I sit kind of thing.
No.
And I think even the stuff that Sonny Bill Williams did when he went to the refugee camps as well, you know, sort of, you know, there does seem to be this new... Yeah, this new confidence, I think, especially in the sports people, which is really, really exciting to me.
It is really exciting, definitely.
Because, like I say, you know, like, you know, as a kid, I just remember these guys, they were just, oh, God, I remember the interviews after the match.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and I remember once seeing, oh, my goodness, is it BJ Williams, Brian? You know, like, I remember seeing him once and just getting his autograph, and he was just like my dad, you know, like,
totally.
Just like, oh, yeah. Whereas a couple of times I've been in pubs where there have been All Blacks, and I've just like, there's some hue around them.
There is.
I don't know whether that's the media has put this on them, but or it's because I see the billboards or what it is, but there is something very different about how they hold themselves, I think.
I think there is, and I think, yeah, I think part of it, there's obviously a lot of other strands to it, part of it is because they are so good at what they do.
Yes.
They are so truly good. Like, there's some YouTube clips. Harland, my partner, and I were watching, there's a sequence of YouTube clips just following the several of the All Blacks around while they're in Europe, and I forget what, I think it was just for the 2015 World Cup. And it's just Tana Umanga, and they show them on the field practicing and stuff. And their skill level is just so extraordinary and so kind of amazing that I think they really do kind of deserve that in a way. But I think that there are probably other strands to that of, you know, sporting men being celebrated a lot.
It was interesting because right the way through this film, obviously because I'm an old, boring feminist, but I kept wondering what, you know, the female equivalent would be like, you know, like what, and I thought, first of all, I thought it wouldn't be an individual woman. I imagined that it would be about the women's rugby team or, you know, something like that. But I was wondering, you know, like, you know, what the like the golfing, you know, equivalent would be. And, you know, and the thing is that I think what's so great about this film is that it brings those two things together. Well, a whole bunch of things together that makes it such an exciting watch is that rugby's extremely dynamic for starters. You know, then you've got the national, then you've got this fantastic arc of losing, then winning. Yeah. And, you know, like it just seems like the perfect storm of good entertainment in a way.
It does.
But I was wondering, you know, I was thinking, what, you know, and I think, you know, going right back to that first thing I said, you know, when I saw the trailers, I was thinking, we have been built up to look at rugby players in this way with a, you know, and you know, a base behind them, lit in a certain way, darkness behind them, power. When I was walking down Queen Street after I saw the movie, I remembered those photos. They're for Adidas, and they're sort of grey and black. And when they open their mouths, they're just all black behind their mouths. And you know, like, and I was just thinking, I don't think the same amount of moneyed kind of art has been thrown at women's sport at all.
No way. I mean, I don't think there's a female team in New Zealand that has had any moneyed art thrown at it. I mean, the only people I can really think of in the world who have that kind of prestige are the Williams sisters. They have that same kind of mythological kind of, I mean, they're just seriously good. But I think, I mean, it actually makes me think of, I guess, just, myth making. Like, creating huge, almost myth-like characters out of these men. And have you read a book, The Book of Fame?
No, I so want to, though.
Honestly, it's absolutely one of the best books in the world. I think maybe, again, it's like the documentary. I so didn't know what to expect from the book. It's a tiny little book. And I so didn't know what to expect. And so I read it just sort of thinking, oh, yeah, this is funny. It's like a first-person plural account of the originals travelling through Europe and winning every single game in, like, 1905 or whenever it was. I actually can't remember the date. But it's an interesting book because it's what's beautiful about it is it's from the point of view of the rugby players as they travel through Europe for the first time ever and win all these games and how they're treated by people. They just become these kind of heroes and they're kind of worshipped. But the, like, diary-style entries are so poetic and beautiful, and they're like the account of a real person, you know, someone who sees nuanced beauty in things, doesn't just play sport. But the interesting thing about it is it is also a myth-making exercise. It is, I guess, a romanticization of them and that time and the origins of rugby, and the origins of, not rugby, of New Zealand rugby. And, you know, I think there's probably an arc there to sort of how they're represented now as well, as, you know, so these sort of invincible, all-powerful, you know, people who,
And, like, then, like, because I was trying to think what, you know, and then what really excites me about that is the fact that a lot of this myth-making is to sell football jerseys and to sell sports equipment and to sell. And I just think it's so interesting that, like, it's not only the country that wants them to succeed, there's all this corporation that wants them to succeed as well, which just kind of blew my mind. And that thing about myth making, like, I was just thinking, the image that came to mind when you mentioned the Williams sisters was the Burley bra ad. And I was thinking, so the boys get to be these warriors that are like, you know, like, will rip your throats out, and the women are like, hello,
I have appendages that need support.
Yes. I need to run, and these things, I don't know what to do with them. Hell, what a mistake that I've got these.
Oh my God.
And I just think that it's so interesting that, I don't know, I just find the whole business of the sport really interesting.
Definitely. I mean, you know, I remember travelling to some kind of sports thing at high school or a bit younger, and there was the netball team and there was the rugby team, and, you know, in the evening after everything had finished, the rugby team were allowed to go out and do stuff, and the girls weren't allowed to go anywhere. They were kept in. And this was like in 1990 something, you know. It's just, and that story of, you know, what was it, the Japanese women's rugby team were travelling to the last Olympics, which, where were they? Were they in Tokyo? Anyway, I can't remember. They were travelling to some big event, and they were the best in the world at the time.
Mm.
And the Japanese men's rugby team were something like 54th in the world. And the men sat in first class and the women were in economy. And I just boggled. I just, my mind boggled at that. And I think, you know, that's still completely the same in New Zealand. I think I don't know.
Because I was just thinking that about netball, because I'm like, I remember, this thing happened where men started playing netball,
right?
Like, you know, like social teams, they decided, oh, men might like netball, there you go. And I just remember all of a sudden it was like, oh, netball is now an okay sport.
I know,
you know, like,
it became kind of cool.
Yeah,
and history.
Yeah,
I remember that happened in Auckland too. It was really, really like, what?
And it was just this odd thing where it's kind of like, oh, netball, a bit boring, you know, whatever. And then now it's like, oh, netball, oh yes, what's happening with netball, you know?
Yeah.
I just think it's really, really interesting.
It is interesting.
My goodness.
Yeah.
So yeah, Book of Fame. I was also thinking about Anne Kennedy, that rugby scene that happens, the Giants, and Time of the Giants, where at the end they're all watching the rugby match. And I was thinking, I don't know, like, man, what, you know, I mean, art and sport, I don't know, how do they relate?
I know, I was sort of thinking about that too, and like, the only thing I could really think of was, I don't know if I actually know of any, apart from the Book of Fame, like, and Time of the Giants, actual rugby represented in art. I feel like one is such a commercial model and one's so kind of not, that they don't tend to marry in that way. But what sort of came into my mind was the New Zealand sort of art motif of the red tractor alone in a huge landscape kind of thing. And I feel like, you know, there's that Michael Smither painting of, I think it's a tiny red tractor with all these giant boulders and a Mount Cook or a Mount something.
Mm, yeah.
And the blue sky and that motif, you know, that of humans being dwarfed by the landscape kind of thing, was something I feel the McCaw doco did too. That kind of like, here is this one man who's, you know, grown up in this rural area and he's going to do this one incredible thing kind of motif. But apart from that, I couldn't really,
because I think this is what's so interesting, is that in a lot of ways the it felt like quite an old-fashioned representation of rugby to
it
me
did,
you know.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I think that's why I enjoyed the footage so much, because that felt like modern rugby. That's what rugby, you know, that's what rugby feels like me today. But
yeah,
I was just thinking in the Lazy Boys, Carl Shuker, there's a very modern take on rugby in that as well. Like, there's a horrendous scene of a rugby party, but you know, like, that whole, they go to a rugby match in Dunedin, and you know, it's huge. And I was just thinking that in a lot of ways, and I wonder again, you know, this idea of why is it not a Tana Umanga documentary? Why is it not a Sonny Bill Williams documentary? Why is it not, you know, like, and I think, I mean, there'll be reasons for that, you know, like, I'm sure. But it is such an interesting idea to sort of return to this idea. Because honestly, sometimes when I was walking through that farm, I just kept thinking of Pine Tree Meads. Like, I just kept thinking of, oh yeah, remember the old days when All Blacks were farmers and everything was cool? And
totally. And in a way, it's like, It's, yeah, so probably one of the main reasons why New Zealand rugby is so good now is because of the people who are playing for the team.
Yeah.
And, yes, there are some, you know, Pine Tree Meads type characters, but there's also people from Fiji and Samoa, people who are Māori. There are these incredible, incredible men playing. So, yeah, to return to that same kind of silent, strong, unemotional man motif is kind of disappointing.
Yeah, it is.
And it kind of undermines why the team, in a way, undermines why the team is as powerful as it is. And I think a lot of that coolness factor actually does come from the characters like Dan Carter and Sonny Bill and stuff like that. And that, you know, if you have people like that who are charismatic, you know, you have an innate confidence that adds to a team's ability to win and adds to a team's recognisability internationally. And that counts for a lot on the field when you're trying to psych another team out. So, yeah, it is interesting that they felt the need to return to that very, very kind of old-school Kiwi motif of a very emotionless
dude. And especially, like, when you think about everything that rugby kind of relies on as far as sort of the image of the warrior, the haka, that's kind of a minefield in itself, totally. You know, like, because, I mean, God, you know, like, the raising that does, you know, and then sort of, like, the shift from one haka to another and, you know, all that sort of stuff, like, it really, it was an interesting move, and I think, and I totally agree, like, I mean, and it seems like, I'm just thinking, like, of the TV shows that I watch about sport. I'm thinking particularly of Friday Night Lights, you know, which is a really white show, you know, set in Texas. And I know, you know, like, I understand about, you know, the racial sort of dynamics of football in America versus some other sports. But, you know, like, it is a really interesting, to sort of, like, it almost whitewash that out of the picture and then say, you know, like, it's wholesome to live in the country. You know, even that thing was quite, I found that quite interesting, is that you have these people that live in cities and were brought up in cities and did their rugby training in cities, and then to have this interesting footage of sort of sheep days and, you know, like, it was so interesting.
It was, and it's only now that we talk about it that I really kind of see that. You know, like, I mean, I was kind of aware of that. I was aware of that, the emotional stuff the whole way through. I found it really, I cannot imagine growing up in a family where you don't share how you feel with people. That to me is so, so foreign and so makes me aware of why I have such a different opinion from a New Zealander who can live, you know, a few blocks away from me and raised in a completely different family. But yeah, it is super interesting that became kind of almost celebrated in the film.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if it was celebrated, but it definitely wasn't, like, challenged in any way, was it?
Yeah, because, I mean, that was what I found super interesting with those shots of him running on the Auckland, down at the viaduct. Mm. You know, like, it appears that he lives in Auckland, obviously, you know, like, I guess you can't be an All Black and not live up there.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, these very... Like, it just seems so strange not to have one image of him eating dinner at a nice restaurant or shopping or, you know, like, I don't know what it's like to be an All Black. But, yeah, I think it really did seem to want to invest something in that idea of, you know, like, and I often feel that in New Zealand sometimes, you know, that I often felt as a kid, because I was growing up in the city, possibly my experience wasn't as New Zealand as, you know, because you'd pick up the school journals and it'd be like, on the farm and feeding the sheep. And I was like, oh, you know, I am scared of sheep. I don't like this. You know, and I do think it's kind of interesting to revisit that.
Definitely. And it's not only just urban versus, not that it has to be versus, but urban versus rural. It's the North Island versus the South Island too. Like, have you had a true Kiwi upbringing if you haven't been raised in the South Island? You know, that's a feeling I have from being from the far north. I'm like, you know, am I a true Kiwi? I don't know.
Because that's what I find so interesting now, because it was the same growing up in Auckland. You know, both my parents are from Invercargill, so this South Island was like this mystical place, you know, like, oh my God, the South Island, Hinterland. The proper island, you know, and like, you know, and in Auckland, and I think that's what's so interesting about this shift now, like, Auckland just seems to be this almost other country, yeah. You know what I mean? And I kind of feel excited about that, you know, like when you go up there you think, yeah, this is totally my opinion, but yeah. I go up there and I think this is what I want New Zealand to be like.
It's exciting,
it feels vibrant, you know, like it just you know,
and stuff is happening.
Yeah it's just, I just found it so interesting.
Yeah,
oh my God.
Totally. And how so many of the All Black team would probably call Auckland, either grew up in Auckland or now call Auckland home. I mean, they're probably a very urban background,
yeah.
I think. I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's what I realised is watching, you know, I realised there was, as I was growing up through the 80s and the 90s, doing my tambourining in class and painting tie-dye silk and stuff like that, there was this whole other thing happening, which was kids being primed for the All Blacks, yeah. Right throughout New Zealand, this huge, huge sporting culture in rural New Zealand and in the cities too, but that I just had nothing to do with apart from watching it with my parents, you know, and that there are these diverse lives happening out there in New Zealand, and I don't really know a lot about them.
Yeah, because I feel the same way. Like, I feel like, you know, like, not the original South Africa tour, but there was a later South Africa tour when I was a teenager and at college, and, like, I was, like, rugby, bad. You know, rugby does not fit with who I am. And yep. like, you know, even through the years, it's sort of been a bit like, oh, yeah, it's rugby, haha, and then secretly kind of watching it and stuff. And, like, I totally agree with what you're saying. Like, it never occurred to me that these guys at our school that were trying so hard and working so hard, it was like, wow, you know, far out, you know, that is something that can come true, and that's been true for a long time, you know, like, maybe now we're living in a country where you can become a, you know, like, when I was a kid, if you wanted to work in movies, New Zealand was not going to happen, but, you know, that seems to happen now. But I think something that was always there was this idea that you could become an All Black, you know, from almost anywhere, you know.
And it was maybe the one kind of New Zealand specific, what do you want to be when you grow up, sort of thing, you know, outside of like a, you know, a fireman, or like I wanted to be a cash register operator.
I wanted to be a supermarket checkout person.
Yes.
Yeah, that was similar.
Mine was to do with wanting to press the buttons.
Yes,
I did
completely.
Love a button. Yeah.
And then I was very upset when it just became barcode reader.
Oh, no, that's not acceptable at all.
Yeah, I like to push buttons. Maybe an accountant. It'd be quite wicked.
Yeah.
What else? Is there anything else? I feel like we've done a good job.
Yes. I think I've sort of talked about most of the things that I wanted to talk about. I mean, the Jungian stuff was definitely the most sort of fascinating, the psychological aspect of it.
And would you recommend people to see the movie?
I would.
Yeah, I think I would as well.
Yeah.
I was thinking, everyone I've been talking to, like, I think, I don't think it's going to change any minds.
No.
Like, I don't think anyone's going to be anti-rugby and go in and be pro-rugby or anything like that. But I think just for that last 20 minutes of football footage,
it was like reliving it, wasn't it? It was like, I was actually doing, like, seat jerks and, like, going, oh, no! Like, it was really, really intense.
I found it incredible as well, because the thing is that I kept willfully kind of forgetting. Like, somehow. Like, that was one of the other great things about the film, and I don't know how they managed it, is that everyone knows the outcome. You know, like, it's like, yeah, I know what happens in this game.
And you're right back there.
Yeah.
Like, are we going to beat France?
Will this happen? Yeah. No, it was fantastic. Hey, thank you so much for coming around.
Thank you for having me.
It was
really
awesome.
Fun.
You rock. Thank
Yay.
You.